Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. One of the unresolved issues of the legislative session is a bill that calls on many of Vermont's smaller school districts to consolidate over the next 4 years. The plan that passed the House gives smaller school districts until 2018 to merge. If they don't do it in that time frame, then a special committee will do it for them. But the Senate rejected this mandatory approach and instead made their plan completely voluntary, and it offered districts larger financial incentives to merge. House Education Chairwoman Joey Donovan insisted that the bill include a mandatory provision, but Senate Education Chairman Dick McCormick rejected this approach.
I think they have to be encouraged by the fact that they have a finite window of opportunity to do it, or else it will probably be suggested a way for them to merge with other districts.
I disagree with that. I think we shouldn't have an end game mandatory point, because maybe it's not a good idea. Maybe the people who don't want to do it are right. If this is a good idea, I think we can trust our school boards to recognize that it's a good idea.
So, should this plan be voluntary or mandatory? That's one of the questions we have today for our guest, and that's Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb. Great to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Your thoughts about school consolidation? Is it a good idea? Do some students at these small schools miss out on some educational opportunities that are available at some of the larger schools? Do we pay way too much attention to student assessment scores, or are these tests needed to ensure that students are learning the skills that they're going to need in the workplace? Great opportunity to talk education issues with the Education Secretary. Once again, our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Better still, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. You know, I'm not sure that some of our listeners know how small some of our school districts are in Vermont. I noticed that Vermont has roughly 282 school districts. 92 of these districts, or about a third, have fewer than 100 students. And there are even some school districts and schools that have 40, 50, 60 students. Now, some people think, Joey Donovan would be one of them, that say, you know, students in these smaller districts don't have the same kind of educational opportunities that students in larger schools have. Do you think that that basic analysis is true?
I think it's worth asking, and first of all, I think you have to talk about elementary schools and high schools differently, because I think there are different issues in different places. I think the smallest school I know of actually in Vermont currently has 19 students, and I was speaking to a representative in the legislature this year who was concerned because her school was spending $9,000 on a single district audit because her school of 19 was part of a single district. And I think the challenge, just to give a little bit of context, I think the challenge of very, very small units in a state like Vermont that has very, very many small units is all the mandates, the federal mandates, the responsibilities of managing and governing and providing accountability for a school fall on every single one of those units. And there are fewer children to spread it over. So the cost, you know, you can't spread that cost over as many students. And I think when Joey Donovan was saying that, I think what the representative was saying is that when you have to carry all these burdens, what you're doing is you're putting your resources into administration and overhead and supervision and not putting your resources into the children, which ultimately is why we have schools and why we care about schools. And so the intent or the logic behind what the House Education Committee was trying to do was to try to find ways to ensure that as much of the precious tax dollars that we spend on education in the state, and we actually spend more than just about any other state, if not all other states, per pupil on education, to make sure that every dollar we spend is getting the best return we can for our kids. And that was the logic of it. And, you know, I think particularly when I look across the state at some of our very small high schools, there's no question that in a very small high school, you can't provide the depth and breadth of options at the secondary level that you could in a larger school. And it's not just high schools, it's also middle schools. I was talking to a superintendent up in North Country, and one of the things that I hear there, but also across the state, is that the high school principals and the tech center directors will tell you, they can almost tell you what town students come from by the kind of preparation they've had prior to arriving at the secondary level. And a lot of it reflects the opportunities districts are able to provide earlier in the system. So in North Country, there's a school that provides no foreign language, very limited math preparation or options to middle school, and very little in the way of no music and limited arts. When they arrive at the high school, they're joining children from other schools who've had much richer preparation, and that really means they begin their high school career, at a disadvantage. And that's, I think, where Representative Donovan is starting in that conversation.
So if you have a mandatory consolidation program, you know, people in small schools see this as a threat to their schools because, you know, here's what they think, that you're going to have a larger district. It's mm-hmm. going to have a larger regional school board. They're going to have much smaller representation on that school board. And at some point, the school board might say, you know, we got five elementary schools all within a 15-mile radius here. I think we got to get rid of one of them. And so these smaller schools say, you know, if they're going to change the whole structure here and close our school down, and we're not going to be able to stop it if we go through consolidation. What about those concerns?
I think the first thing to acknowledge is that this is an intensely emotional issue because the reality, and I'm a parent and I understand that, there's nothing, when you send your child to school, it's an act of faith, and there's nothing we care about more than the care of our children. And so I think the desire to hold our children close to our community is a desire to make sure that we're doing the best we can. And, you know, I understand that. And that's exactly what the advocates of one-room schoolhouses felt 100 years ago when we had one-room schoolhouses and we were talking about closing them and putting in the town schools. I understand that because change is hard and you know, it's a high-risk proposition. As a teacher, when people send you their children, they're sending the thing that they value most in the world. And education is an incredibly conservative proposition because of the risk involved. We want to make sure that when we do something radical, we know it is going to be better for kids because it's a sacred trust. We owe our kids no less. So I understand that tension. I think that the challenge is always to step back and ask ourselves, what is it we want for our children, and how will we know if we have it? And then to ask the question, what's the best way to deliver it? And I guess the reason I say that is, you know, I in my early career in Vermont, I worked in a district that did actually go through a district merger. And at the time, one of the towns that we merged with had 100% turnover of teachers every year, and I think 100% turnover of principals as well for 2 years running. And that's catastrophic for a school, that kind of turnover. And it happens when a system is so stressed financially that it can't provide teachers and children with the kinds of support they need to make a viable program for schools. And I have no question in that particular case, in that merger, that the children in those towns and another town in that merger had similar issues. I have no question that they were better post-consolidation. That district did result in one closure. And at the time, we ended up deciding to build a new building on the town line near the town line, but in one of the towns, to provide a new facility to the children from Verscher and West Fairley. And there was a really pivotal moment in that whole discussion, I think, in the district. And that's when we were at a town meeting and talking about building a new school. And we knew that if we were going to close a village school in Verscher, we owed it to those children to give them something better. And that facility was out of code. It was very difficult. It really limited what the teachers were able to do instructionally. And so we were committed to providing them a better program, including a program that might be able to put in a preschool for the children in those towns. And I remember we were at a meeting talking about it, and somebody stood up at that meeting and said, giving these kids a new school is like dressing up a tramp in a top hat. And I just have to say that because what that person was saying is these kids don't deserve a better facility. They don't deserve better than we're giving them to me. And I really have to give credit to my our school board chair in Fairley, who ended up being the chair of the new interstate district, Alan Avery. You may know him. He was a senator here in Montpelier for a while, who was an incredibly pragmatic man, driven by very realistic assessment. You know, he's a businessman. But he was also driven by making sure that every child, no matter what town they were in, had access to high-quality education. And when he looked at that town and he saw, it wasn't that the voters didn't care. They were voting. They had a very high tax rate. They were trying. But he looked at their town and he knew that in that small school, they were not going to be able to find the kind of stability they needed, nor to get their children the kind of building that would support the program they wanted to offer. And he spoke right back to that community member and said, it doesn't matter where they're born. All of our children deserve better opportunities. And I feel in that case, he had the vision to ask ourselves, not how do we preserve what we have physically, but how do we preserve what we care about in terms of a strong sense of community and a really high quality program that enables all of our children to learn and thrive in their communities. And that's really, I think the question is Vermonters, we have to ask. It's going to look different in every community. Rivendell picked a solution that worked for them then. They may need a new solution now. But that's what communities do. They come together, they argue, they debate, and they figure out how to do better for their children, but how to do it in a sustainable way.
Today in the program, our guest is Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb. We've been talking about school consolidation, many other issues as well. You can join the conversation at 1-800-639-2211. Let's turn to Heidi in Salisbury. Hi, Heidi. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. I'm enjoying the conversation very much. I'm a retired teacher, very interested in these topics, and I just would really ask that this discussion be very wide and very deep. We're talking not only about the education of children, but we're talking about the function of our communities and the function of democracy. It's conceivable that if we consolidate, then towns are going to lose their town meeting because there won't be anything meaningful to talk about or vote on during town meeting. I've been a supporter of small community schools. I do feel like we probably need to completely restructure, but the discussions really have to be very wide and very deep. It's more than just education that we're talking about here. So we need to be fostering community and resilient communities for the climate change things that are coming at us. And so whatever we come up with needs to give community school boards something meaningful to do, voters something, and residents something meaningful to do, as well as addressing the educational needs of kids. So thank you.
What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I couldn't agree more with Heidi. I mean, Heidi, I grew up in, I was trying to count this the other day. I think I grew up in, I went to 7 different schools between kindergarten and 12th grade. I've lived in 6 countries, and I keep coming back to Vermont. And one of the reasons I keep coming back to Vermont is that one of the things I absolutely love about Vermont is the very high level of public engagement. And we don't always agree, but we do come together to argue and discuss and debate what the best way is to live a good life in Vermont. And I think that's so integral to the fabric of Vermont, and it's so integral to the health of our schools and our communities. So I do profoundly agree on that. I also realize that, you know, we need to also be broad in terms of how we think about solutions, because I'm also very concerned. And in my own experience, I've seen towns torn apart by a lack of economic sustainability when your costs are so high that the only local control you have is deciding which of your teachers to cut. That's also very corrosive and destructive to town communities. So part of having a strong and healthy community is having the community come together to find a sustainable solution that allows us to continue to thrive. And I agree completely that it's a very complex issue which is going to defy easy solution. And I think that's partly why we have the current outcome of the recent legislative session. I think if there is a consensus out of the legislative session, it is that we need to do something, because the quality and the economic sustainability of our school system is in jeopardy, and with that, our communities. But I don't think we have yet consensus around what the right solution is.
Well, what do you think that path is? I mean, it's mandatory, it's voluntary. The state for the last couple of years has had an incentive program in place for school districts to encourage them to merge. Not many school districts seem very interested in that. So some folks say, you know, if you have the voluntary approach with more financial incentives, it's probably not going to encourage very many districts to do it, and therefore you need more of a mandatory model saying, okay, you got 4 or 5 years. If you can't figure it out by then, we're going to come in and do it for you. So How does the state address this issue kind of from this point forward? What's the best path?
I actually have to go back and correct something you said, because I think one of the challenges is not... It's not that most districts aren't interested in doing it. And when you look at some of the votes that have taken place, often a majority of towns actually vote to form the new union. But there's often one town that doesn't. And it doesn't go through if one of five towns chooses not to approve it. So you may actually have a majority of voters overall supporting it in the majority of towns. But it can't form if everyone isn't agreed, if you don't have consensus. So actually there is... interest. And I think another piece of this that's the challenge is, and this is part of I wasn't privy in all the discussions, but I assume part of what was driving the House Education Committee was that what we see across the state at the agency is that there are districts who are in crisis right now, and we see them going into distress, and they're in this sort of death spiral where what they begin to do is cut programs. And as they begin to cut options, I mean, we have schools where, from their data that's reported to us, they have such limited options that children leaving those schools really aren't prepared if they want to apply to a competitive four-year program, for example, in a college. And what happens is that many of the parents who are the best educated and the most able really to advocate for improvements in those schools look at the school, feel it's not adequate for their children, and pull them out. And when that begins to happen, what you lose is the internal capacity in the school and the community to make that a thriving school. The problem is, because these districts are not contiguous, they're not necessarily seated next to each other, so they're not in actual partnership with other districts in the same situation, they can't find a dance partner when they hit that need to look at scale as a way to maintain high quality for their kids. And that's the challenge. I mean, they're scattered across the state, and some of them have been looking for years. And we have a district that we just spoke with a couple of weeks ago that just gave up looking for a Vermont partner, and now they're trying to form another interstate district because they can't interest any of their Vermont neighbors in looking at any kind of collaboration. It doesn't mean they're not interested. It just means that there's no shared consensus. And, I think in the case of Rivendell, each of the districts was very different, and it came to the table for very, very different reasons. In the case of Fairleigh, which was a more affluent town, I think the reason it came to the table in part was Act 60, and realizing that was going to be a pivotal event for them. But also they were struggling because Fairleigh was a tuition town that sent all its students to secondary schools in the area, and predominantly to a school that had very high tuition rates. And as Fairleigh struggled to maintain the quality of its elementary program, and as the tuitions were increasing, it couldn't vote on tuitions. We actually didn't vote on most of our budget because most of our budget was in the supervisory union, or at the secondary level. The only place we could make cuts to support any increases was at the elementary level. And part of the precipitating event to look at a more sustainable situation for that town was to say, how can we find a way to have a continuous K-12 system so we can build our program continuously and preserve quality across that K-12 continuum, but also in a sustainable way? And, again, I realize that these are very complicated issues. And in that case, it came out of, we had forums in every single town repeatedly to sit down and ask people about what we wanted for our schools, what we want our students to know and be able to do when they left. And I think that one of the things that was pivotal in forming the district was to be able to realize that despite our historical rivalries and the fact that our sports teams played against each other, we realized that we actually all wanted the same thing for our children. And when we actually began to collaborate and pool some of our resources, we were able to provide much better opportunities for our kids, and it made them happier.
Today on the program, we're discussing education issues with Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb. Our number, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb, and our number is 1-800-639-2211. Lots of education issues to talk about in the rest of the program. I'm just wondering, next year in January, the House Education Committee, the Senate Education Committee, they're going to come back, they're going to revisit this issue. What advice do you have? How does the state look at this in a productive way and to have a pathway to discuss consolidation. And we had an email from Michelle who wants to know, you know, how do schools and communities engage in this conversation? What would you like to see happen over the course of the next 6 to 8 months?
I think the first advice I would give to all of us, including myself, is to, you know, a lot of people who come and speak to me and they're really concerned about the future and the change and losing small schools. They all cite E.F. Schumacher and Small is Beautiful. And you know, I agree. I love that. But I think, you know, Schumacher himself said that real life consists of these tensions between opposites and the incompatibility of those opposites. And I think that's a little bit of what we have here in some cases. And the reality of schools is we have to make compromises and we have to decide what we care about most. And then how do we realize that, given the constraints that we have? I want an island in Hawaii. I'm never going to have one. I care deeply about schools and making sure that every child in the state of Vermont has a high-quality school. And I'm going to continue this conversation until that's the goal that we get closer to, realizing that that's a dream we'll always be chasing. One of the things that the agency can do to try to help support that conversation, because I think we do need to continue this conversation, is try to see what data we have that really speaks to some of the questions that are on the table. And something we haven't done systematically is really analyze what are the differences in opportunities across the state that we're seeing in small schools versus large schools. And some of that we can now support because we have some new data at the agency that's been reported to us by schools so that hopefully we can begin to play back some of that information so that school boards can look at what they're, when they spend, you know, when they spend $14,000 per pupil, what are they getting for it? What's that money buying? And how is that a function of the kind of system or the kind of governance structure they have? So we're hoping to support some data collection, but also some analysis that's a little bit more sophisticated so that when the legislature returns, we actually have some better answers to some of the kinds of questions that we're being asked. And also that we can provide it to local community members. So we need to think about accountability and school quality a little bit more broadly and make sure that we have better tools for local board members and local community members to use as they talk about how to make their schools better and ensure kids in their schools have the kinds of opportunities they hope for. So that's one thing we'll continue to do, push that conversation.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to John in Stratford. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. One of the things I noticed with Rebecca talking was on the Rivendell district was the amount of forums, the amount of local input, the bottom-up solution for that district where people in that own district came together and made decisions. The problem with the consolidation bill that was passed by the House, which would eliminate our local school boards, was it was a top-down mandated bill. And what we need to have, you know, and I speak with one who's worked for the last 31 years in an outstanding small school that has produced wonderful, wonderful students, is you need to have each, this has to be a bottom-up issue. And Dick McCormick in the Senate had it right. You can't force a cookie-cutter solution on the entire state. You will not only, you will lose some of your good quality students, and you will lose the most effective advocates that you have for good schools, which are your local school boards.
John, that's great. And I hear you, and I have a question for you. I'd just be curious, how can we help support those conversations statewide? Because one of the things that concerns me is that there are some towns that really need to be engaging in those conversations, and we don't see it happening yet. And what can we do to help support that? Because the reality is there are some schools that are going to be looking at declining revenues associated with declining enrollments for the foreseeable future. And how do we help communities begin those conversations so that as they develop viable solutions, you know, kids aren't suffering in the interim? Because we do see schools in the state where we feel kids are really suffering because communities haven't moved.
Rebecca, one of the things in the Senate bill was actually money for forums. To discuss these very issues. And I think rather than going back and trying to force a mandated bill in next legislative session, you first, like you did in Rivendell, you develop forums work from the bottom up. Each district is different. One of the beauties of Vermont is that we are different. We are different towns. You learn from what's worked in different places, and you develop this whole idea from the bottom up rather than a mandated cookie-cutter top-down solution.
And I hear you, John. I'm still asking, how do we start that conversation? Because, you know, in I think part of what brought Fairleigh to the table, to be honest, was Act 60, and that was an outside precipitating event. And we actually did those forums without financial support from the outside. That was a local decision. And there is some money, you know, that available. I mean, it's, you know, if for the districts that are currently involved in exploring consolidation studies under the state board, there is, you know, the, part of that process could be communicating or having community forums to discuss some of these issues. And that hasn't been the instinct of the towns. So I'm quite serious and genuine. I'm saying, how do we encourage communities to begin having these conversations? Because I think that the quality of our school is also linked to the economic sustainability of our system. And when I look at the data and the indicators, I don't think we are in an economically sustainable situation.
I mean, would it be fair to say that it would be your hope that most communities and school districts in Vermont over the course of the next 6 months, year or so, would start to have these conversations and say, you know, let's take a look at the size of our school district. Let's look at educational opportunities. Let's take a serious look at how students are doing. Is that sort of the process, the engagement that you would like to see communities do?
I think it has to happen. I think the other challenge of it, and this is something that the state is going to have to grapple with, and that's why I think this conversation is going to come back to the legislature, is that there is and you know, I spoke about opposite tensions. One of the tensions is this tension between, as a state, are we committed to making sure that every child has opportunities to learn, or do we see this as a local town responsibility? So it's really up to each town on its own bottom. Because if our goal is every child, then we are going to have conversations across districts, because we are increasingly a socioeconomically stratified state. And when you look at where the declines in enrollment are concentrated, they tend to be concentrated in less affluent and rural communities. And that's where I think the schools are suffering the most. Where you see the increases happening, they tend to be happening in more affluent towns or in some of the larger areas like Burlington. And those towns have more options just because they have growth and because they have a more sustainable system, and they have more resources behind them to back those systems. So, you know, some of these very, I don't want to name anyone, but some of these very small towns, they can have conversations till the end of time. And at the end of the day, some of them, their schools will close because they do not have the resources internally in their communities to actually build a sustainable future. And as our population in the state ages, that will only be more the case. So John, I really hear you, and I share your conviction. I don't know how to communicate a sense of urgency to all the towns. I find that some of the towns that should be having the conversation haven't started yet, and there are other towns that are doing very, very well, and they don't see this as an issue that's relevant to them. But because of the way our funding system is structured, because we really are a state that has committed to equal opportunities for all children, and we have a shared ed fund, the decisions in one town actually do affect the decisions in another town, and that's going to affect all of us. So, we're independent, but we're also linked. You know, our state motto is liberty and union. We can have freedom and liberty at the local level, but at the end of the day, I do feel that the economic viability and our ability to educate all our children, and quite frankly, the children who tend to stay in state and be the workers in Vermont in the next generation, is going to require a statewide conversation.
Let's get a quick call in from Heather in North Bennington. Hi, Heather. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I have two things. Firstly, I would hope that they would look at the studies from other states who have consolidated that basically show that there's been minimal savings for those states that have consolidated. And I'm very concerned that the legislature hasn't looked at other governance structures like we did here in North Bennington. North Bennington Graded School was a public school that went independent, and we've been looking at our financial issues for some years now and realized that we needed to do something. So we did go independent, and we're doing fantastic. The school's thriving in many different ways. However, the state doesn't seem to want to look at going independent as a governance structure that might be possible for other schools that are struggling, small schools that are struggling. So, you know, I would love it if the legislature could look in that direction. And also, please don't refer to our independent school as private, because we're not. We actually serve all of the students that are in our district. So I know the state was concerned about that, but we do serve all the students regardless of their abilities.
Okay, Heather, thanks very much for your phone call. What do you think about that model there?
I think Heather raised two really good questions, and I'll try to be quick because I know we're running out of time. We actually have refused to talk about savings out of the agency because what we tend to find, we call them freed resources, because we do find that when districts have consolidated, they have freed resources by reducing overhead costs. But what they tend to do is immediately invest them back into improving program and quality of program instead of returning them to taxpayers. So the reason there are no savings is because of local control. People choose to reinvest. And in terms of privatization, I have to say that, you know, we have a long tradition. And when you look at the historical academies of Vermont, they were initially established as public schools with a different governance structure, and their mission is public service. And if we lost those, we would not be able to serve children in large areas of the state. So I don't think that's ever been taken off the table. The specific solution that they're discussing with respect to North Bennington isn't a viable option for many towns because it isn't financially viable. In fact, we do have some indications that that actually the North Bennington school is experiencing some economic stress, and it may be that because of their circumstances, because of the relative affluence of the town, that they may be able to weather it, and we wish them well. Those are our kids, and I'm pleased to hear from Heather that those kids are experiencing a wonderful program, and that's a wonderful thing. It's not a viable option. If you take a small school that has a substantial number of phantom students and students for whom they're reimbursed but who are no longer attending because of declining enrollments, they've lost enrollments, or the small schools grant, when you lose the small schools grant, when you begin to back those revenues out of the budgets of our very small schools, many of these schools couldn't afford to go private anyway. The kinds of challenges that some of the small independent schools are facing are similar to some of the schools that the Vermont public schools are facing, which is that we have lost 20% of our enrollment in the last 15, 20 years. There are not enough students to fill these schools, and that is something that public schools and private schools are grappling with.
We're almost out of time. We've got about 40 seconds. What's the biggest challenge you face in the next year?
My goal is to keep talking about quality of teaching and learning, because I find that people want to talk about governance, they want to talk about how we structure schools, and at the end of the day, what really matters is what we do in the classroom and how we support our teachers who are working very hard. And, you know, when you think about what we're asking them to do right now in terms of changing the way they teach to really prepare students for some of the challenges of the 21st century, my goal is to keep the lens on learning and keep the lens on the teachers who are working so hard to help our students across the state.
There are a lot of issues that we want to talk to you about, school testing, teacher testing, early education. Didn't have a chance to get to them today, but I hope you'll be able to come back in the not-too-distant future and talk with us again.
I'd love it. Those are all topics close to my heart.
Great. Thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Coming up next, I'll talk with retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis about why Vermont Republicans are having such a hard time finding a candidate to run for governor this year. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. In just a few weeks, we should know the lineup for the major party candidates running for statewide and legislative races. That's because the deadline for filing petitions is Thursday, June 12th. Who will seek the Republican nomination for governor? And will the Republicans have candidates for most of the other statewide offices? Or will they concentrate their resources on winning more seats in the legislature? With us now to give us some insight into these questions is retired Middlebury College political science professor Eric Davis. Hi, Eric.
Good afternoon, Bob.
Eric, we're 3 weeks away from the filing deadline, and it's not clear at all who will seek the Republican nomination for governor. Here's what we do know. Stowe Representative Heidi Sherman has decided not to run, and businessman Bruce Lissman announced this week that he wouldn't be a candidate either. So the only GOP candidate we are sure of right now is Emily Payton. She has her petitions in. She ran as an independent candidate for governor in 2010 and 2012. But the Republican Party has said they won't support her if she wins their primary. And still on the sideline at this point are former gubernatorial candidate Randy Brock and Barry businessman Scott Milne. So what does it mean that we're this close to the filing deadline and the Republicans don't have a candidate that they can support?
Well, what's going on is the effect of some of the long-term structural aspects of Vermont politics. It's been over 50 years since an incumbent governor seeking re-election was defeated for re-election. We also know that Vermont is one of the two or three most heavily Democratic states in the whole country. And added to those more general factors, we have Peter Shumlin planning to run for re-election for a third term with over $1 million in his campaign account. So putting together all those factors, it's not an encouraging situation for a Republican to seriously contend for governor this year. And someone like Heidi Sherman, who may have ambitions for a political career over the longer term, the idea of her running for governor was well received by many people. But after looking at the race, she decided that, in effect, the likelihood of her winning was sufficiently low that she didn't want to give up her seat in the legislature from Stowe and thus losing any ability to influence policy over the next 2 years.
Now, Eric, there was a recent poll that found that Governor Shumlin has a favorable rating under 50%. His disapproval rating was in the low 40s. Doesn't that usually spell trouble for an incumbent?
Not necessarily, because you need someone to beat the incumbent with. And the two people who are being talked about now that you mentioned, Scott Milne, owns a travel agency. Apparently, he's out of the country and will be still until pretty close to the filing deadline. So he's going to face a lot of challenges in terms of getting a campaign organized, raising money, getting his name known, and all those sorts of things. Randy Brock did run 2 years ago, so he has higher name recognition. He demonstrated 2 years ago he had the willingness to put some of his own resources into his campaign, but he lost by about 20 percentage points to Shumlin in 2012, and even if he could close that gap by half in 2014, he's still 10 points behind the governor.
So as Randy Brock looks at this race, and as you mentioned, he lost by roughly 20 points in 2012, why would he think the results this year would be any different?
It's hard to come up with a plausible argument for any Republican candidate being able to close that gap. Even though Shumlin's disapproval rate is higher than it's been in the past, his net rating is still positive. He's in the news almost every day just by being governor. In fact, you could argue that the two-year term for Vermont governors is one of the factors that makes it very difficult to defeat incumbents, because in effect they can campaign without doing so. And then Shumlin has been assiduously raising money ever since he became governor, and now has over $1 million.
So Eric, a fair number of Republicans are hoping that Barry businessman Scott Milne jumps into this race. But nobody really knows who he is. He has no name recognition. As you mentioned, Shumlin has a lot of money. Scott Milne's only political experience is an unsuccessful race for the Vermont House. How does Scott Milne overcome these challenges?
What he has to hope is to get as much news coverage for his campaign as possible and find some people who are willing to put some money into his campaign so that he can buy advertising. But the more money Republican donors give to Scott Milne, the less money there might be available for legislative races. And one could make the argument that strategic deployment of a relatively small amount of money would enable Republicans to pick up some seats in both the Vermont House and the Vermont Senate, And even though they wouldn't win a majority in either chamber, if they could at least pick up a few seats, that would enable them to claim something positive next November.
And what do you think the chances are that they could do that?
Well, again, it would require careful targeting. I mean, there's 30 seats in the Senate and 150 in the House, and most of them, either the incumbent who holds the seat now or if it's an open seat, someone from the same party will win. But if you look at the election results from the last two cycles, there are some areas of the state, particularly the northern part of the state, Franklin County, parts of the Northeast Kingdom, and then Rutland County, where Republicans have done relatively well in recent election cycles. And there are some democratically held seats in those areas of the state where if the Republicans recruited strong candidates and helped them out with organizing and getting their message out and some sort of grassroots activity and advertising that's focused on concerns in the district, I believe it's possible the Republicans could pick up anywhere from, say, 1 to 3 seats in the state Senate and maybe half a dozen seats in the House.
Now, Eric, as I mentioned, Emily Payton is in the GOP race because she has submitted the necessary petitions to the Secretary of State's office. Although she ran as an independent in 2010 and 2012, she told me that she thinks she's going to be able to get some support in the Republican primary based on her position on a number of issues. She wants to accelerate the development of renewable energy sources. She's proposed eliminating the property tax and the income tax and replacing it with a roughly 25% sales tax with a rebate system for lower-income Vermonters. Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott told me on this program last week that the Republicans will have a credible candidate for governor because they do not want Emily Payton to be the party nominee. What do you make of this situation?
Well, Emily Payton will get some support on her own merits. Her views on public policy issues are hard to categorize, but I think she's a mix sort of redistributionist in economic policy and radical libertarianism and some social policy. And there are some people in Vermont who find that policy mix attractive and will vote for her. The other possibility is, since there doesn't appear there's going to be any statewide primaries on the Democratic side and only a few scattered legislative primaries on the Democratic side, it is possible that some Democrats would vote for Emily Payton in the Republican primary, or some independents as well, vote for Emily Payton in the Republican primary just to make things difficult for the Republican Party. We saw that scenario back in 1998 when Fred Tuttle defeated Jack McMullen in a Republican primary for the U.S. Senate nomination to run against Pat Leahy. And while it's implausible that such an outcome will happen, it is not impossible.
Is it more likely that would happen if someone like Scott Milne runs?
I think it's more likely to happen if it's a very, very low turnout election. The turnout in Republican primaries has been very low in the last several cycles. It might be as low as 20,000. So only 10,000 votes would be necessary to win. And the smaller the turnout, I think the more likely it is you could have an unusual outcome.
So, Eric, I'm wondering, if the Republicans don't have a strong gubernatorial candidate, does that affect the legislative races at all?
Yes, it does, because there'll be no sort of organized Republican Party activity. At least in 2012, you had Randy Brock, who was a respected member of the state Senate. He had been state auditor. So he was a sort of a high-profile candidate who had some previous political experience who was leading the Republican ticket. If the Republican ticket this year is the top candidate is Scott Milne, you're not going to have that. Also this year, there are no U.S. Senate races in Vermont. So again, there will not be some high-profile Republican who might get involved in one of those races.
Well, in just a few weeks, the election picture for this year's campaign will be very clear. And Eric, when that happens, let's have another conversation.
Very good, Bob.
Thanks for being on the program.
My pleasure.
Political analyst Eric Davis is a professor emeritus at Middlebury College. This Monday is Memorial Day. It's a time when all Americans are asked to remember soldiers who have died in war. Yesterday, the Vermont National Guard held a ceremony for those Guard members who died in Iraq and Afghanistan and for their families. Here are some of the remarks from that ceremony, accompanied by the Vermont Guard's 40th Army Band.
In a time when everything is delivered to your fingertips, a text message, an email, a tweet, it's important not to trivialize what Memorial Day really means. Today's ceremony is intended to honor the fallen from all conflicts and all branches of service. Today, let us honor the memory of the men and women whose sacrifice is a beacon of hope that democracy, freedom, equality, and lasting peace can prevail. Our men and women in uniform who've worked tirelessly and faced grave danger to protect our liberties and make our world a safer place for future generations going forward. Let us honor the principles these men and women have stood for, the principles that led them to volunteer to wear a uniform and fight for the freedoms of their loved ones.
So that the sacrifice remembered today might be honored by the way we courageously live out such a legacy of service before self.
Those were the voices of Major General Steve Cray, Sergeant Major Neil Roberts, Major Michael Midas, and Governor Peter Shumlin. They all spoke yesterday at a Memorial Day ceremony for Vermont Guard soldiers who were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's it for today's program. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangari, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great Memorial Day weekend.